Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. While our peripatetic president strikes out in all directions, tweeting out attacks on NAFTA, DACA, and Amazon, we'll begin with the stock market taking a hit today as investors worry that Trump is precipitating a trade war with China. Matt Gold, a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law, who previously held an appointment within the executive office of the president as deputy assistant U.S. trade representative for North America, joins us. We'll discuss the dangers of such a woefully ignorant president without impulse control threatening a trade war, who has no grasp of history when it comes to the lessons from the nativist boneheaded Smoot-Hawley tariffs in 1930, which plunged the country and the world into the Great Depression. We'll assess whether Trump will get a reality check as the stock market he takes credit for plunges and his tariffs start to cause job losses, which might also get the attention of Republican congressional leaders facing a tough election year. Then we'll speak with Michael Copps, a former FCC commissioner who currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. He joins us to discuss America's Ministry of Truth and the Orwellian dictates from the owners of the Sinclair Group, who are forcing their news anchors at their soon-to-be 215 TV stations to all read the same propaganda script in a Soviet-style effort to portray themselves as the fair and balanced media while labeling real news fake news. With an overwhelming number of Americans opposed to the Sinclair Tribune merger and the FCC's gutting of net neutrality, we will speculate whether the democratic will of the majority will overcome the money and influence power of the inside the Beltway minority. Then finally, with strikes by teachers having erupted in West Virginia and now spreading to Kentucky and Oklahoma, we will speak with Tammy Berlin, an arts and humanities teacher at Atherton High School in Kentucky and vice president of the Jefferson County Teachers Association. She joins us from Kentucky's capital, where she's participating in a statewide teacher strike to force the legislature to fund schools and pay teachers a living wage. And joining us now is Matt Gold, who's a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the renegotiations of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements, and has been a consultant to the White House, National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress. And he's previously held an appointment within the executive office of the president as the deputy assistant U.S. trade representative for North America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Gold.
Glad to be here.
Well, it looks as though the stock exchange is getting rattled by the portent of a trade war. The ghost of Smoot-Hawley seems to be haunting us again. And Donald Trump, of course, has precipitated this. What's your sense of how far the Chinese are going to take this?
I think the Chinese are going to take it as far as they have to. Right now, Donald Trump is threatening to engage in a retaliation against China outside the WTO process. If Trump moves inside the WTO process, which he's given his U.S. trade representative the option of doing, I think it will not lead to a trade war. But if Trump steps outside the WTO process for retaliation, then I think it will quickly will go downhill.
But will it also mean the end of the WTO?
Well, the WTO is a much bigger, broader, more important institution than most people realize, and it's not really the organization. It's the WTO agreements, the 30 multilateral trade agreements to which 164 countries have become parties. It wouldn't completely collapse immediately. It has more resilience than that, but the consequences of its collapse are so serious that even the possibility of its collapse are definitely rattling markets, and in my view, should be rattling markets even more than they are.
So is Donald Trump a kind of bull in a china shop? Because just as a journalist trying to keep up with him, it's really hard work. And I've had to call people back after I'd interview them to re-interview them because of something that's happened in the interim. Just over the weekend, he was tweeting out a suggestion that he would use NAFTA negotiations and DACA as a way to use them for leverage to get his wall, end DACA and renegotiate NAFTA. So is that just another avenue that we have to follow? I don't see a coherent policy here so much as a president who strikes out on a daily basis with a tweet or literally on almost throwing a cat amongst the pigeons on a daily basis.
Yeah, a lot of what Trump says is throwaway noise. Some of it isn't. For example, the steel and aluminum tariffs are something that he moved into after a year-long investigation and process by the U.S. Department of Commerce. The retaliatory tariffs on China are something he moved into after an investigation by the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative that went on for more than 6 months. These are things that take a long time to prepare. So when he took steps to move in that direction, we knew that this was serious. On the flip side, you know, this business about Mexico paying for the wall and, you know, that's all just background noise. It gets lost in dead air. The NAFTA renegotiation, President Trump just only has a certain amount of leverage. And no matter how many times he tries to create leverage out of nothing, he will continue to fail. And so these comments regarding the NAFTA renegotiation really don't, it's sort of like sound in space. It just dies.
And another, he's striking out in another direction as well, going after Amazon, whose stock has taken a hit based upon a total falsehood that somehow the post office is being bankrupted by Amazon, when in fact it's being, if anything, revived by Amazon, and its real problems are that it was stuck with an onerous payments of health and prepayments of health and welfare benefits, which has crippled it for the last decade or so. So that seems odd on top of everything else, going after a successful American business. What's your sense? Again, I'm trying to find some kind of coherence here or ideology or strategy.
Well, it's sadly with Donald Trump, I honestly and sincerely believe that he doesn't have a coherence or ideology or strategy. I think the way to understand where Trump is coming from and to try to predict not only where his words come from, but whether his words are going to go anywhere, is to look at the origin of his words. In so many cases, these are things that started on the campaign trail. And whatever he said on the campaign trail that found resonance among his base, he continued to say, whether it had any basis in reality or not. And then when he got into office, and his staffers tried to figure out how to actually move forward with policies and programs to implement that, they found in some cases there was no way to move and nowhere to go, and in some cases they could try to do things. And then you have to look at the issue for issue, what they're trying to do, and figure out whether that's really possible or not.
So given that one of the regular refrains from President Trump to his audience has been talking up how great the stock market is, and obviously people with 401ks are pretty happy to see the stock market go up, but now it's being rattled, and I imagine if there's more reciprocity, and again, reciprocity is a word that Trump likes to use a lot, in terms of tit-for-tat tariffs, the market's going to take even greater hit, isn't it? I mean, so at that point, do you think maybe that might get the president's attention?
Well, if it gets a lot worse, but remember, the markets have gone up significantly since Donald Trump took office. When the Dow takes a 500-point or 450-point hit, as it did today, that still doesn't bring it down anywhere near to where it was when Donald Trump took the oath of office. So I think Trump probably feels fairly secure that he's not in that territory where people are going to start re-evaluating their judgment of him based on the market taking a hit like it took today. So long as Trump delivered to his constituency a Congress, which in turn delivered the tax cut that they delivered a couple of months ago, I think that combined with some of the strong fundamentals that in the economy that President Obama handed off to Donald Trump probably will keep the stock market in a good place until and unless this business with China really devolves into a back-and-forth trade war. And that won't happen again until and unless it becomes clear that Trump is going to move outside the WTO process for retaliation.
But do you think it's possible to educate Donald Trump? I mean, apparently Gary Cohn, the head of the White House Economic Council, tried to, because Trump honestly sees trade deficit. He sees trade as a zero-sum situation. So if you know, at the moment, our trade imbalance with the EU is $151 billion, $435 billion in imports, $284 billion in exports. So to Trump's mind, that means we're getting ripped off to the tune of $151 billion.
Yeah, and that's really not the way trade balance works. That's not a score sheet of winning and losing. And, you know, he doesn't understand that. Either he doesn't understand it or he's so convinced that his constituents never will understand it, he can always continue to speak in those terms. But no, there's no way to educate Donald Trump. He is so grossly uninformed and uninterested in learning, from what we hear from insiders. He really has weak analytical skills, and he really has a serious impulse control problem. So, you know, all those things are necessary not only to gain information, analyze information, but to also have some discipline in terms of implementing policy. So I don't see that. I mean, I think President Trump has a lot of emotional baggage, many emotional problems that really prevent him from ever becoming serious in terms of developing strategy and following through on it.
And what about Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell weighing in? Because won't it be a situation where the other, I mean, apart from the tax cuts, which Donald Trump is touting, and he is going up in the polls. There's no denying that these economic numbers look good for Trump, and he's quick to claim credit. But what happens when we start losing jobs because of a trade war?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that right now everything inside the Beltway in Washington is about the congressional midterm elections this coming November. And although Donald Trump's opinion polls are going up, Republicans running for re-election in the House and the Senate are really running into problems. There's a risk, and certainly not a certainty, but a risk that the Republicans are going to get crushed in the midterms, and Trump could have his party lose control of the House, conceivably even the Senate. So that's a big concern, irrespective of Trump's own personal numbers. Certainly, if we get into a major trade war with China, I think Trump's own numbers are going to start going down fast, and I think the stock market is going to start taking even a bigger hit than what we've seen, to the point that it's going to start going down to or past where it was when Donald Trump took the oath of office. But that would really require the trade war devolving into several more rounds and getting a lot more serious. But it could happen. So that's the trajectory you're looking at.
So I mentioned Smoot-Hawley. There is, of course, the historical precedent that in the 1930s, this sort of boneheaded nativist Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was passed. And pretty much all historians attribute that asinine move under President Herbert Hoover. In fact, apparently the head of J.P. Morgan Bank at the time, which was the Goldman Sachs of the day, got down on his knees begging Herbert Hoover to veto this Smoot-Hawley tariff, which, of course, he didn't do. But then it deepened the 1929 depression for many years to come. So there's a glaring historical example. You talk about the Beltway. I know there aren't too many historians inside the Beltway, but nevertheless, is the ghost of Smoot-Hawley still haunting the place? Do people recognize the dangers of going down this path?
Inside the Beltway, everybody does. The problem is, and I wouldn't call this a problem, but the issue is that in the days of modern communication mean that each member of Congress has a constituency that has that member of Congress on a much shorter and tighter leash than constituents used to have their members of Congress. And so the problem is so many people outside the Beltway across America don't know that historical lesson. And my God, the consequences of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs enacted not only by a Republican House of Representatives and a Republican Senate and signed into law by Herbert Hoover, Republican president, after the market crash, not only did that really launch us into the Depression, the Great Depression, but it did far worse than just even the Great Depression. It started a trade war between the U.S. and Europe, And then the European countries ended up with a trade war all against one another because they didn't have the European Union in those days. They were all separate countries for trade purposes. And that led to a downward spiral where the economy of Europe literally collapsed to the point that currencies were worthless. There were runs on banks. And then an obscure political party that had been around in Germany for 10 years and everyone had ignored, never gotten any traction, called the Nazi Party, suddenly took over the legislature and the chancellor's office in 1932. And that led to the greatest catastrophe in the history of human civilization. So, you know, the consequences of that trade war go far beyond just simply a depression.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Matt Gold, as I said earlier, there's so many issues to try and cover here within the purview of this conversation about trade, about the market tanking today, fears over a trade war with China, using perhaps NAFTA negotiations and ending DACA as leverage to get his wall, which he made pretty clear in tweets over the weekend. Let's just touch on that one. What are the chances of that? Because at one point, the Democrats offered $25 billion in exchange for a path to citizenship for the DACA recipients, and Trump turned them down. So the fact that already the Democrats have offered $25 billion for this ridiculous waste of money, that troubles me, frankly. So do you ever see that being revisited? Is he ever going to get his wall? Because that would be a testament to the – to talk about the folly of Smoot-Hawley, that would be a testament to the folly of our government to waste that kind of money.
Yeah, you know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi really stunned a lot of the people in their own party, a lot of the Democrats, by being willing to give Donald Trump a meaningful chunk of change for his wall in order to save DACA. And the blowback, I mean, Trump didn't accept the deal, but the blowback that the Democratic Party leadership in the House and the Senate received from their own party suggests that they probably would not be willing to make the same deal again. But you don't know. It would be stunning if they were foolish enough to give a bully that victory, to let Trump literally hold these dreamers hostage, literally hold them hostage. I mean, literally hold them hostage to get a $25 billion waste of money on his wall. If for the Democrats to let the bully pull that off would just be a political, just a huge political mistake by Schumer and Pelosi. On the flip side, they almost made that mistake once. You know, it's hard to know whether they would do it again.
Well, let's hope that he doesn't get his wall, and Mexico is certainly not going to pay for it, right?
Yeah, no, a wall built by the United States inside the United States for the United States purposes, whatever they are, is not going to be paid for by Mexico. That was a burst out loud laughing suggestion by Trump. And it is, the idea of it is as absurd as it ever was.
And even the incredible negotiating skills of Jared Kushner aren't sufficient to pry that money loose from Mexico?
Oh, well, those skills are tremendous. But, of course, you know, they're dedicated to the process of making peace in the Middle East as you and I speak. So they're tied up somewhere else.
Okay. Well, Matt Gold, I thank you for joining us here today.
All right. Well, thank you. Good to talk to you, Ian.
Good to talk to you, Matt. And again, I've been speaking with Matt Gold, who's a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the renegotiation of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements, and has been a consultant to the White House, National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. And he previously held an appointment within the Executive Office of the President as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. We're going to take a brief station break and be looking into Sinclair, America's Ministry of Truth, who are forcing their news anchors to read Soviet-style propaganda as they portray themselves as fair and balanced media while labeling real news fake news.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. It's all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound that makes the world go round.
money, 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 money.
Looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the savage yore of 1984. See, come see, remember me.
Lay down the all night movie road. You said it would last, but I guess we grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Copps.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Michael. And the Sinclair Broadcasting Group had all of its news anchors recite the same script, basically saying, unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal biases and agenda to control exactly what people think. Well, and it went on to say how the warning about fake news and promising to be fair and balanced, like Fox News promises to be fair and balanced.
Yes.
So this is basically the Putin tactic from Russia, where you accuse the You accuse your accusers, and Donald Trump does the same thing. He accuses anybody and everybody of doing exactly what he's doing. So this is pretty brazen stuff. And how do you think it's going to affect the merger? Because the FCC is now controlled by an absolutely aggressive partisan, Ajit Pai, who pushed through ending net neutrality in an arrogant a dismissive way. They even manipulated the enormous data against them. I mean, 99% of the public supposes it from what I can tell, and yet he just arrogantly went ahead and did the bidding of the big telecom companies. So what can we hope for here in terms of something
well,
at the FCC?
I don't think too much. All we can hope for is that the public gets sufficiently energized. As you say, there's no question that a majority of people in the United States of America oppose these big corporate mergers and oppose what's happened to local news and diversity news and community news and all the rest. But I don't think the Trump tweet is going to have that much effect on the merger because, as you note, the merger seems to be on pretty much of a fast track for approval by this brazen and rather audacious FCC that we have right now. It's just amazing how these folks have come into power at the FCC, and these are people who are always talking about reasoned discourse and taking our time and having a rational discussion, and they've just come in with a weed whacker and undone, you know, 50 or 60 years of things that the Federal Communications Commission has been trying to do to protect and safeguard the public interest. That's the job of the FCC, to protect the public interest. And when it comes to mergers, its job is to make sure if it's going to approve a merger that it advances the public interest. And there is nothing that I can see in this proposed Sinclair acquisition of Tribune that advances the public interest. It's just another one of the huge corporate merger deals that does its damage to localism, and this one comes with an ideology on top of all the rest, and it comes with very tough control from the top, where they have forced editorials that their local anchor people are supposed to read or are directed to read on air. And it's just another sad chapter in the evisceration of journalism and the evisceration of a diverse media. And to me, it's one of the greatest problems that the country faces right now. We're a country with a lot of serious problems facing us. We rely on an informed electorate to help us make decisions for the future of the country, and we are skating perilously close to where we don't have an informed electorate capable of making those decisions because the media is suffocating them with all this infotainment and reality show politics and not doing the investigative journalism it's supposed to be doing to enlighten the citizenry.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. And of course, President Trump tweeted out his support for Sinclair today, and the government approval to acquire Tribune Media for $3.9 billion is underway. The deal would give Sinclair 215 stations covering over 72% of American households. So it's a big deal. And that in itself is something the FCC used to be able to restrain, but not anymore. But have we ever in this country had paid propagandists like they do, you know, in the Soviet Union and in China, Russia Today, and other countries where you basically don't have news, you have propaganda? It doesn't seem to be that. I can't think of an American tradition where you actually had propagandists. You've had demagogues like Father Coughlin and others.
We've had demagogues. We've had yellow journalism and very opinionated type of journalism. But it's getting now, so it's so corporatized and it's so pervasive across so much of our media that it is really inflicting civic damage like no previous instance in my memory has ever done.
Well, but you can see it online. Somebody put together all of the Sinclair anchors reciting from exactly the same script. Yeah. And it's a frightening thing to watch because it really encapsulates what the nature of propaganda is, because it is totally George Orwell. It's 1984. It's the Ministry of Truth. As I say, I can't think of an American example of this before. So it feels like we're in new territory. And, of course, the merger hasn't even happened with Tribune, and Sinclair is already flexing its propaganda muscles.
Well, it is. And, you know, this is a company, I've called it the most dangerous company that most Americans have never heard of. You know, we've all heard of NBC and ABC and CBS and all the rest, but not many people until now have heard much of Sinclair. Maybe Trump's tweet will boomerang a little bit and people will look into it a little more, but what this Sinclair merger is all about. But it is an echo chamber, and it's one that's stimulated by all the new technologies that we have going for us now. And I think you make a valid point that this is unprecedented. And when you don't have the counterpoint to it, when you don't have the independent journalists and the independent stations around the country who can point out what's going on, then we're playing fast and loose, not only with the media, we're playing fast and loose with the American people, too.
So what's with this family, then, the Smith family? You have to go back to the Fairness Doctrine to recognize the simple elegance.
Yes,
the elegant
right.
simplicity, I think, is a way to put it, of what FDR put through there, which means if you're a media baron and you want to use your media assets as your private soapbox to propagate your personal political views and inflict them on the public, you have to offer equal and opposite time to other people with an opposite point of view. And that had the effect of moderating speech. And this is really how America's changed to the point now. The center in this country, the political center, has been hollowed out. More and more partisanship now is drifting to the right and drifting to the left. The Congress is dysfunctional because they see each other as enemies in this tribal way. I could go on pointing out what a damaging situation it has been since getting rid of the Fairness Doctrine. But what's your sense of whether or not people recognize the role of...
this is a company. Going back to the first part there, this is a company that has twisted and distorted and tried to take advantage of every public interest protection and rule that the FCC had against one company gaining so much power, and no one company should exercise that kind of power where you have over 70% of the American people listening to them. But, you know, they've worked it out so different family members own this and own that. They control a lot of stations that they don't own. There are ownership limits that were on the books. The Pai FCC, Ajit Pai FCC, is trying to get rid of them all now, but they have taken advantage. Sinclair has taken advantage of these for I call them joint evasion agreements. They're like local marketing agreements and sales agreements where they for all practical purposes, they run a station. They enjoy profits from the station, but they don't own it because that might still be contrary to those older FCC rules. But those rules are going by the board. And, you know, there's negotiations going on now, apparently, between the FCC and Sinclair over will they sell off some of the stations that might put them over certain limits. But they've got all these corporate lawyers working on this so that they can still control those stations and they can still profit them, and down the line they can outright own them. It's just a company that just is push wherever they can, and push beyond the far beyond the spirit of the law. And you know, I've spoken out against these corporate mergers for years and years and years, ever since I went to the FCC, but this is a particularly bad one because it comes with such almost authoritarian control at the top, and it comes with an ideology. And you know, if they're looking for an antidote to fake news, maybe they could try real news. I think that would be the best antidote.
But the extent to which, you know, they're already tied to the White House. This one of the more extreme people that was gotten rid of, along with Sebastian Gorka, was this guy Boris Epstein.
Right.
And now he's their regular commentator.
Writing their editorials. Right.
Right. And then they package them and they send them out to all of their affiliates and make them put them on the air. And they did
well,
they put them on the air
and they get the local anchor people, who people have a tendency to trust, to read this drivel on the air, and that presents another degree of the problem that we haven't had before. And it's my understanding in some places, like in Seattle, some of the local people, the local anchor people, have taken a grave exception to being asked to do this sort of thing.
Well, to the other question, though, and the damage that highly partisan media has done to our politics, do you think that you can make a case that getting rid of the fairness doctrine and then Fox hitting the ground running and right-wing talk radio hitting the ground running to create this sort of right-wing echo chamber that we have in our media that is in many ways a kind of mirror of what they have in Russia? And by the way, there's an interesting documentary made by a Russian-American called Our New President. And what it does is it takes all of the Russian media clips from the way they covered the American election and how much they were cheerleaders for Donald Trump, and just plays it back to us. And it's exactly a mirror of what Fox News does. This is, I think, we've paid a high price for this in terms of, I think you can trace government dysfunction to the way that advocacy media now has polarized the country on the right and the left, to the point where there's no center to work with anymore.
Well, I don't think there's any question but that you're 100% on the mark with that observation. It's a sad day. It's not, you know, and it's not just ideological. In this case, you do have, and in Fox's case, you do have that very identifiable right-wing ideology. But in other cases, you know, it's more of a corporatized mentality, and a lot of news, even on the other stations and on the networks, and in many of our newspapers too. Just you read about this stuff in the business section, not on the front pages. You read about how they're doing business-wise and competition-wise, but you don't really see the stories about serving the public interest and teeing up issues. We just came through a presidential election in 2016, which was totally unlike anything we've ever had before. It was just a reality show. And, you know, who's going to get voted off the island for making this gaffe or that particular gaffe, but don't worry too much about the issues. And you had people like Les Moonves, who runs CBS, saying he didn't know if Donald Trump was good for America or not, but he sure as hell was good for CBS. And, you know, that's what so many of these corporatized, consolidated, conglomerated networks that own so many stations now are talking about. So we're not getting the investigative journalism. We're not getting the local news. We're not finding out what's going on in our communities with the school board and the mayor's office and things like that. In many, many cases, I'm not saying universally, because there are still some independent stations left and papers left that are doing a good job, but so much of media has become beholden to the unforgiving expectations of the marketplace, and that has done incalculable damage in my mind.
Well, you know, it was the mainstream media, CBS included, that gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising by covering him as a reality TV show.
Exactly.
So they have a lot to answer for. And given his success, it's hard to believe that that it won't be emulated, right?
Nor is this just a Republican versus Democratic issue. It's not that at all. If you look at the feelings of the polls, they're talking about mergers. I saw one on the AT&T Time Warner thing. I've seen others on net neutrality. Huge majorities of the American people are for strong net neutrality rules. Huge majorities don't like that AT&T Time Warner merger. I don't think they like the Sinclair merger either. But inside this beltway, you don't find that kind of, and those are Republicans as well as Democrats. I think on the AT&T Time Warner one, it was like in opposition to the proposed merger, was like 66% of Democrats, 65% of independents, and 64% of Republicans or something like that who opposed the merger. It's only inside this beltway in Washington, D.C., where corporate power reigns so supremely, where campaign contributions have so much to do with determining where public servants stand on these issues. Once you get outside the beltway, I think you'll find a lot of people, a lot of Republicans, a lot of Trump voters are not happy with the state of the media right now. I don't think they're happy with high cable bills right now, high broadband bills, or all the rest. So I think if we can work from that realization, if we can find some leverage there at the grassroots, that in the final determination is what's going to it's going to make for a better media. We're a long way from that now. A lot of people are not aware of these issues, and that again is largely media's fault. Thank God we've got folks like you and some others who cover these issues, but in the final analysis, nothing good for our media is going to come out of Washington, D.C. in the next few years. So whatever hope we have resides in the grassroots and the realization of people and the insistence of the people that we have to have a media, a traditional media, and now an internet that serves the public interest, protects our privacy, covers real issues, and informs us as a democratic electorate.
And as you pointed out, to some extent, democracy has already been hijacked, because the majority of the people oppose getting rid of net neutrality, oppose the Sinclair merger. But it's all happening within the Beltway because of the money power and the plutocratic power of these media barons like Murdoch and the Smith family that own Sinclair. But we got people power, they got money power. It's time. I guess it's time for people power to get up and make their voices heard, right?
Well, if we're going to have that kind of information that we need to successfully run this country, I often go back to James Madison and his statement, you know, a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and the people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives. I think that's just as apropos right now as when little Jimmy said that 200 years ago.
Well, that's a good note to end on, and I thank you for joining us, Michael Copps.
It's always a privilege to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011. He's currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a school teacher in Kentucky who joins us from the state's capital, where she's participating in a strike to fund schools and pay teachers a living wage.
Bruce Brother! Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
There once was a union maid. She never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called. When the company boys come around, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tammy Berlin, who's an arts and humanities teacher at Atherton High School in Kentucky and vice president of the Jefferson County Teachers Association. She joins us from Kentucky's capital, where she's participating in the statewide teacher strike. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tammy Berlin.
Hello.
Hi, Tammy, and I guess all of Kentucky's schools are closed today, right?
Yes, we are. This is spring break for most of our districts, but the 25 or so districts that were supposed to be in session have shut down for the day.
And at this point, today is also the legislature's day to pass the budget, right?
Right. This is the last day of their 60-day session, so they'll be working into the night and may do the old stop-the-clock trick to get it all in before they adjourn.
Well, but already they've pulled some fast ones, haven't they? Attaching
they
a spending bill,
yeah.
A reform bill, if they want to call it that.
Yeah, the pension reform bill. They passed the pension reform bill on Thursday night. They had put out a pension reform bill that we had killed twice, and they were intent on getting it through. So Thursday evening, they did a Senate committee substitution, substituted the text, a watered-down version of the pension reform bill text, for a sewage bill, and passed it through both houses in record time without any kind of actuarial analysis that is required by statute. So the procedure they used to pass it is actually illegal. We'll be challenging that in court. But we were able, because we had killed the pension bill twice, we were able to get them to move off a lot of the really bad stuff. So we did get some concessions in it. And so that passed. But once they passed that on Thursday evening, we turned our attention to the budget, which is where the real problems lie. We have not had any kind of meaningful revenue increases in Kentucky over the last more than a decade. And so our schools are underfunded. Most of our districts are not funded at the recommended per pupil allotment. And so we are here today demanding increases in school funding. We're demanding full funding for family resource centers and pre-K and all of the wraparound services that our students depend on. And we're also here demanding full funding for the actuarially required contributions to all of the state's pension systems. So we're here because we need revenue in Kentucky, and they need to pass meaningful revenue reform today.
And of course, preceding your strike in Kentucky, Tammy, there was a teachers' walkout and strike in West Virginia that
yes, there was.
Appeared to be, I think, pretty successful, was it not?
It was quite successful, and we were standing right behind them in solidarity, and we know that they are standing behind us as well.
And added to that, of course, teachers are on strike in Oklahoma as well.
Yes.
So what's
I've been following that today.
Right. So what's the pattern here of why schools' budgets are cut and teachers' salaries have been flat for a decade, as you pointed out.
Well, if you'll look at these three states, plus also Arizona, I know they're going through some issues as well. If you look at these states, you'll see that they are all red states. We just, in Kentucky, we just lost the last Democratic House in the South a year ago. And so we're Republican in all, both chambers of the legislature and also the governor's mansion. And so because we've had a conservative Senate for a long time, we have not had any, like I said before, we have not had any kind of meaningful raising of revenue. And so in these red states, we're looking at, they're trying to be fiscally conservative and they don't want to pass any kind of revenue increases. So that has trickled down to austerity in our schools, and we can't allow that to happen.
But don't they also do tax cuts for big corporations as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, we worked with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, which is a political think tank that does work on budget and finance for the state. And their research revealed that if Kentucky closed the tax loopholes on just 10% of the corporate tax breaks that we give out in the state, that it would be enough to pay everything that we need for our pensions and then some. So, you know, really all we need is some closing of some tax loopholes to get the funding that we need for our schools and for our kids.
And again, I'm speaking with Tammy Berlin, who's an arts and humanities teacher at Atherton High School in Kentucky and vice president of the Jefferson County Teachers Association. She joins us from Kentucky's capital, where she's participating in the statewide teachers' strike. But some of these states as well, I'm not sure about your own. I think it's happening in Kentucky, is it not? That while teachers don't get a raise and school budgets are cut, or while tax breaks are given to big corporations, aren't they also pushing for charter schools as well?
Yes, they are. And so we just passed a charter law last legislative session, so the 2017 session. We have been one of the last and most recent states to pass a charter law. Right now they're still developing regs, and the regs are pending approval at the state level with the State Department of Education. But as much as they would like to have charters in Kentucky, they have realized that they can't afford them under this budget. So the budget bill that they are looking at today that is likely to pass does not actually carry any funding for charter schools. So, you know, it's a sad thing when our schools are broke, that we're so broke in this state that they can't afford to do some of the regressive things like charter schools that they want to do.
Well, I guess that's an ironic blessing, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
The charter school thing never made any sense, because if your public schools are failing, then you take more money away from them.
Exactly, that does not make any sense. So
right.
At least for now, it looks like the budget that they're probably going to pass today does not include any charter school funding.
So there's 30,000 teachers on strike in Oklahoma City as well, and in the state of Oklahoma, demonstrating at their state capital, and you're demonstrating at your state capital in Kentucky. And is that Frankfort?
Yes, Frankfort, Kentucky.
Uh-huh. So describe the scene. There is, what, about 5,000 teachers?
I would say more. I have been up on the third floor of the Capitol building looking out where I can I've been managing some social media from up there, and I've had a really good view of the crowd. We had a really large crowd of about 25,000 teachers that came to the Capitol in a situation much like this back in 2004 over state funding of the public employee health care. And we had actually voted to go on strike for that. And so that was in 2004, just about this time of year. The crowd that we had today, I think, was pretty much equal or possibly a little bit bigger than the crowd we had back then. And I think we were in the tens of thousands back in 2004. So I believe we had more than that today.
So when you mentioned earlier, Tammy Berlin, that these states that have been had teacher strikes, starting with West Virginia and now Kentucky and Oklahoma, that they all basically all branches of state government are controlled by Republicans. What's happening in terms of the Democratic representation in the states? You say you're down, you just lost your last Democratic congressperson. There's supposed to be a kind of blue wave that's being generated in response to the Donald Trump presidency.
Absolutely. I think that is for sure happening here in Kentucky. I believe it was Mark Twain that made the joke that when the world ends, he wants to be in Kentucky because everything gets to Kentucky 20 years after it does the rest of the nation. So we were kind of behind the rest of the South in terms of the state turning red. So if we can not be so far behind on getting some of those seats back to more progressive legislators, then that will be a good thing. I know that we have 40 classroom teachers who are currently running for public office. Many of them are running for House or Senate in the state right now. So, and that 40 is growing by the day. Our treasurer at my local, a young man named Andrew Bailey, just filed to run against one of the senators today. So, we're trying to expand that blue wave.
So tell me about your two state senators. One of them is even unpopular with his own, with the Republicans, Rand Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And particularly his colleagues in the Senate. But yeah. Senator Mitch McConnell, of course, is the majority leader. He survived a challenge, didn't he, in the last round. When is the next time that Rand Paul is up for re-election? He seems to be vulnerable, isn't he?
Yeah, and I am not certain of when their dates are. I believe Mitch McConnell might be up in 2020, but don't quote me on that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're both coming up again soon, not immediately. So, we always have people who are willing to take them on. So we will be looking for a good candidate to get behind.
And what about the congressional races? A good candidate stepping up? Do you think that the blue wave is going to sweep
through?
Well,
I live in Louisville, and we are blessed to have John Yarmuth. So we're quite happy with him. We just need some more progressive candidates for the other congressional districts in the state.
So just back to the teacher strike. So attaching this so-called reform package in the dead of night to the sewerage bill, which certainly, shall we say, stinks a little. Then
stinks a lot.
Stinks. And then you've got the showdown now in the state capitol over the budget itself. So what you're hoping then is that somehow they can get sensible, find resources for education, and then some of that money can make up for what you didn't get in the so-called reform package. Is that the strategy here?
We're looking. Well, the pension reform has passed, and so that's a done deal. We just need the ARC funded, the actuarially required contributions. That's what we need for our pensions. So we're pushing hard for that today. But even more than that, we are pushing for funding for our schools and for supports for our students. So, like I said before, they have been looking at cutting funding for the per pupil expenditure. They've been looking at cutting funding for our family resource centers in our schools. They've been looking at cutting funding for pre-K and a lot of the support services like health services for students and ECE and things like that. So we have been pushing back hard today on those potential cuts, and I think we're making some progress with that. The last I heard, the bill that they're looking on did not have many of those bad things for kids in it. So if we can come out with a budget that supports kids and protects our school funding, then we'll be satisfied with where we have left the day.
But just in closing, Tammy Berlin, it seems that certainly with, in the case of West Virginia, and I believe Kentucky as well as Oklahoma, that the teachers themselves seem to be getting ahead of their own unions. So we know that there's also an active effort in this country by the Koch brothers and other right-wing donors, billionaire donors, that they're basically trying to destroy public sector unions. The Supreme Court is poised to rule on it. So give us a sense of what's going on. This is not the only front that you're fighting on. You're trying
right.
to get the state to give you a living wage, but at the same time, the union that represents you or public service unions in general are under threat of being defunded, which is a way for the Republicans to take funding away from Democrats.
Well, I believe that's true, but I think the best counter to that is to offer a union to our members that is strong and active and involved on issues that they care about. And I don't know of anything that teachers care about more than advocating for children and for funding for their schools. So, you know, they, whatever the Supreme Court is going to do with the Janus case, they're going to do that, but we're going to keep advocating for kids.
Well, Tammy Berlin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Tammy Berlin, who's an arts and humanities teacher at Atherton High School in Kentucky and vice president of the Jefferson County Teachers Association. She joined us from Kentucky's capital, where she's participating in the statewide teachers strike. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.